Score, the podcast. The only show taking you inside the studios of the world's most celebrated composers and musical storytellers. Presented by Spitfire Audio.
I'm Kenny Holmes.
Hey, I'm Robert Kraft.
This is Score, the podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio, saying hello to composer Carol, who's also joining the show as usual.
Hey, guys.
Hi, composer Carol.
Hello.
Everyone good? Everyone have a good 4th of July weekend? Safe? Everyone has all their fingers?
Well, I think one thing that we can all agree on is you don't have to go to fireworks anymore. They come to you.
Yeah.
Our backyard was in a somewhat of a war zone. I don't know where the war zone specifically was, but there were atom bombs in my neighborhood.
Yeah, Carol, your neighbor's house caught on fire, right?
My neighbor's house was on fire. It was so loud, even until like 4 a.m. It was crazy. But it's, you know, once in a year kind of thing.
Sheesh. And,
you hope.
You know, I don't know. We'll see.
Well, I'm glad everyone's okay. We hope you had a nice holiday weekend. We have a terrific guest joining us this week. He's somebody that we've talked about getting on the show. We got a chance to spend some time with him when shooting the documentary Score. He is an Oscar and Golden Globe nominated composer for, here's the list of films: Hamlet, Sense and Sensibility, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, Caesar, Gosford Park, Thor, Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, Cinderella, Brave, Henry V, Dead Again. And there's so many more. He's been in the game for quite some time, and I'm so excited to have a big smile on my face for this interview, because if you haven't heard our guest, Patrick Doyle, who's coming on the show, if you haven't heard a conversation with him or just hearing him talk, is just it fills up the room. There's a lot of positive energy. Robert, you worked with him on Rise of the Planet of the Apes. Is that the only film?
Oh, no. We've had a lot of fun together. We did Planet of the Apes. We did the film Aragon.
Oh, that's right, Aragon.
About a flying dragon, the less said the better. We also did Great Expectations together. Really wonderful film. That's actually the first time I worked with Patrick, and just was really overwhelmed by how much I loved his music. I didn't realize until that film that he does a certain thing that just gets to me with his music. And not only that, as you said, he's just the greatest hang.
I'm also excited to ask him about, we were doing some research on him, and in his IMDb listing, the very first thing listed is an appearance as an actor in the movie Chariots of Fire. And I haven't had a chance to go back and rewatch the movie, but we got to ask him, what? He's an actor in Chariots of Fire. It doesn't look like a big role, but I'm excited to hear what that story is all about.
Yeah.
As always, before we jump into the show here, we want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Spitfire Audio, maker of orchestral virtual instruments for film composers, used by many of the guests right here on the show. In fact, at the end of our Terrence Blanchard interview, he said, make sure to tell the Spitfire guys I did the Five Bloods, and I think Perry Mason with Spitfire.
I think everybody's using Spitfire these days. It's really become an industry standard. And they currently have these two new editions of their best-selling BBC Symphony Orchestra library, including the Discover Edition, which is a whole symphony orchestra at your fingertips, and it's just $49. And if for some reason in this strange time we're in, the $49 is out of your current budget, you can complete a form on the Spitfire website and get it free.
I just did it.
In 2 weeks.
I just did it. I filled out the form.
I did it too.
I'm getting it on July 18th. I can't wait. We also want to mention Spitfire's new Composer Magazine, all sorts of different spreads and photographs. You can read an in-depth interview about the Witcher composers on how they approached the music of that show and so much more. So go ahead and check that out on the Spitfire Audio website.
The best news for all of you devoted Score listeners is we have a great deal for you. It's 20% off your first purchase. Good on over 50 different Spitfire libraries. First of all, to think that you can choose from 50 libraries and get 20% off, all you have to do is use our promo code. It's SCORE2020, and it's a limited time offer. So I'd go right now. I'd actually hit pause, walk over, buy a couple libraries for 20% off, and then be sure to stick around for today's show. At the end, we're going to play a cue using the Spitfire Solo Strings package.
That's a good one.
Really wonderful package.
And I do want to make a quick announcement here that after today's episode, we are taking a few weeks off to regroup. Doing this show remotely has been a little bit of a task, so we're going to get our ducks in a row, and we have an incredible lineup of guests coming for the conclusion of season three. We have quite a few episodes left, and the guests I cannot wait to announce, and we can't wait to sit down and talk with some of those amazing composers. So stick around and stick with us for season three here. We appreciate all the love we've been getting on there. It's been an interesting week. We had a big blow to the film music world as the legendary maestro Ennio Morricone passed away at the age of 91. He, of course, has composed so many of the greatest scores. I think over 500 films, which is just incredible.
Yeah, he actually has a record, I think, a current record of he scored 20 films in a single year once, he said in an interview. So he works fast. You know, Ennio, once I had an opportunity to work with him, and one of the things that he said, which I always found just an indication of his greatness and his focus, he said that once he was flying from Los Angeles back to Rome, you know, he worked out of Rome almost exclusively and rarely traveled.
Yeah, he was big on Italy. He made it a point to famously do all his interviews in Italian and have them translated too.
Exactly right. And if you wanted an Ennio Morricone score, you went to the Forum Studios in Rome, which in itself was an incredible experience. But once he was flying back to Rome, he said, they had to circle because of weather. And he said, I was so grateful because I had one cue that I just couldn't finish and still needed to work on. So I was hoping the weather would stay bad long enough for me to finish this piece of music before we landed. And I thought, now that's different. If I was on an airplane, all I'd want to think about is, man, I can't wait to get on the ground. Ennio just thought, I'm in a little bubble of writing. I don't want to land. I hope the weather stays bad. And I thought, that's a true artist. True artist to be that devoted.
The impact that he's had, first off, you know, I always point to like John Williams and Jaws for something like when I was a kid, before I had even seen Jaws or heard the music, it was so injected into our culture. When you jump in the pool, you start humming the Jaws theme. And it's the same thing with Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. That sound, that spaghetti Western sound, is synonymous with if you're playing cowboys outside when you were a kid or when anytime you see anything related to like a Western, you can't tell that story without Ennio Morricone. And it just goes to show you, you know, Metallica covering The Ecstasy of Gold. The Ecstasy of Gold used in a Jay-Z rap song. Yo-Yo Ma covering it. Like, look at all the different types of music that are pulling from that and the impact that he had on all different genres of music. And that's just his spaghetti Western stuff. I mean, he had such range of all these different films. And, of course, he finally won his Oscar in 2016 for The Hateful Eight, which he did with Quentin Tarantino. And we wanted to play you a little clip of his Oscar acceptance speech. After all the years of composing, he finally won his Oscar.
And the Oscar goes to Ennio Morricone, The Hateful Eight, my brother, Di Fratellino.
Ringrazio l'Accademia per questo prestigioso riconoscimento.
Thank you, the Academy, for this prestigious acknowledgement.
Il mio pensiero va agli altri nominati, in particolare allo stimato John Williams.
My tribute goes to the other nominees and in particular to the esteemed John Williams.
Non c'è una musica importante senza un grande film che la ispiri.
There isn't a great soundtrack without a great movie that inspires it.
He takes the time to thank John Williams. I just found that so cool and inspiring that somebody who's a legend in his own right and he thanks John Williams. And how cool that Quincy Jones presented him the award too. And we know Quincy's always traveling around Europe. He probably spent a lot of time with him as well.
I'm sure. You know, I think he says something in Italian to him, Quincy speaking every possible language. Quincy always says you just need to know a few words in each language to make friends. But
I love that quote.
It's a great
though,
loss.
There isn't a great soundtrack without a great movie that inspires it.
It's so true. And we all know it. And it's really a testament to Ennio that he is that humble, that he thanks John Williams. I think these guys, I'm sure, danced around and near each other for their entire careers. But it's a great loss. He's a hero. He's an original. And he did things his way. And that's a testament to his artistry. I mean, you had to come to the Forum in Rome. He would not speak English. I did a movie at the Forum, and he had a translator, and you'd ask a question, and the translator would very politely say the translated version of, no, the maestro is not going to change that cue. That's the way it goes. And you didn't argue. You could ask politely for changes, but he'd say, this is what's best for the movie, and you trusted him.
What I think is great about art is that when someone passes on, it really highlights their art. I mean, if there's a positive spin to the sad news, it's that everyone is listening to Ennio, and hopefully new audiences are hearing him and sharing it. And, you know, take a minute to go through. We have the luxury of digital libraries. You have everything at your fingertips. Just take a minute and listen through to some of his stuff. And I'm sure it's going to be skyrocketing to the top of all the playlists for the next couple weeks as people listen through.
I think there's some signature scores. We can end with this. Some signature Ennio scores besides The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, where we all know that ocarina theme. I think there are certain that are just classics. The Mission is just a huge score. And The Untouchables, one of my all-time favorite scores.
Carol, wasn't your the one that inspired you?
The love theme from Cinema.
And Cinema Paradiso, that was the other one. So I think if you listen to those three or four, you'd see what great Ennio Morricone scores sound like.
And even The Hateful Eight more recently.
And The Hateful Eight, of course.
What a life and what a talent, and RIP to the great maestro Ennio Morricone.
Good maestro.
We want to take a second to check Score the Mailbox.
Is there an atom bomb in Score the Mailbox? Sounds like my backyard.
We have some mail to check if we can switch gears. Not an easy transition, but the best we'll do for now. We have a message in from Ben Hayden, who is a student at Davidson University in North Carolina. Ben writes, for the orchestral musicians out there, how do you think the desired skill set of orchestral instrumentalists recording scores differs from the skill set of typical orchestral performers? Meaning, what is the difference between a studio musician, somebody playing on one of these teams for a score, versus a normal orchestral concert player?
Oh, that's a question I've been asked by lots of perspiring young musicians, and it even comes up in interviews.
I think I have one quick answer for you, and that's
The ability to sight read. There are a couple really quick answers. Say it again.
The ability to sight read is a key element to that. You don't practice, so.
You absolutely nailed criteria number one, which is, and I think we have enough of an adult audience to say what studio musicians and film music say. You got to sight read fly shit, which means there are lots of little dots and quarter notes and eighth notes and 32nd notes flying by on a piece of music you've never seen. And by the way, they're recording you, so you have to play it first time every time incredibly accurately. That's very different with a symphony orchestra musician who gets to rehearse, and I'm sure there's pressure on them, but it's not like time is money at the level that it is in film music. So the first criteria is you have to be able to sight read just at a huge speed, truly sight speed. You also have to be very, very flexible and non-diva-like about what you're asked to play, because you can bet that you're going to be told, can you guys do this this way? Can you guys do this this way? Can you play pizzicato? No, actually, I want it to be legato. No, actually, could you play rubato? No, could you? You can't say, dude, you know, I've had it. Your job is to be the engine of a driver who's the composer, and often the conductor, and without attitude, because your days are 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. break, 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. break, 6 to 9 or 7 to 10, and then you get to sleep. And if you're lucky, you're back at 10 a.m. the next morning, and you're getting 10-minute breaks, and it's really a very professional application of your skill set. So
let me ask you one question. In your years of overseeing scoring sessions, has there ever been a musician that you saw that was just not hitting the notes and there was frustration? Or are these generally, I mean, when you get to that level, is there not even the possibility of someone being that green?
It's a really wonderful question, because it makes me envision all those scoring sessions. And my answer to, if there was a musician who is not hitting their marks, they were only there for one session, maybe not even the entire session. Because those sessions, you know, you have 90 players in the room. What you need is the intermediary, which is someone like Peter Rotter or the great Sandy DeCrescent or Gina Zamidi. These are the great contractors who book the players, and they know it's on them to make sure that they have only the varsity in that room, because you can't afford to
start over.
Except the third violinist was out of tune or out of time or forgot their mark. So you can be sure there's a team that you see over and over again, day after day, that's the absolute A team. The only other thing that's different about orchestral musicians and studio orchestras is orchestral musicians can play in St. Louis or Miami or Budapest or Argentina. Studio musicians have to be where movies are being scored, and that still remains a very small amount of locations. New York and London and LA, of course, Seattle, and sometimes Nashville now, and sometimes Prague, but
yeah.
There's, you know, you need to have all the equipment and right personnel to play in a studio.
I wonder if that'll change as we move forward and a lot more remote stuff has opened up.
You're absolutely right. It could. You could live anywhere, I guess, at this point, and play solo. You just have to play in tune and in time.
You're talking about the Olympic team, if you will, of you know, the studio musicians. You have to be flawless every time. And if you're not, they'll find someone that is, I think, at that rate.
Yeah, see ya.
Thanks for the question, Ben Hayden. And if you have a question for the show, you can send it to scorethemailbox@epicleft.com. We'll try and get to your question right here on the show. Now, before we take a break and we get to Patrick Doyle, I want to play something really special for our listeners. Normally, we don't do this, but it brought so much joy to us, and my stomach still hurts from laughing so hard. So as you hear in our breaks, we have our guests. We ask them to read a little liner to bring us back out of break. Hey, you're listening to Score the Podcast. And so we asked Patrick Doyle to do this. And he said, sure. He did one take. And while he was doing it, I think Robert talked in the middle, or there was something. And we asked him to do one more take. And then this situation unfolded. And it might be the funniest thing that I've heard in a long time.
Anyway, listen, guys, thank you very much. Oh, I'm going to do it now. Have a great day.
One more take, yeah.
Do you want to, like, hi, this is Patrick Doyle. You're listening to me. I can have an Edinburgh. Hello, it's Patrick Doyle here. You listen to Score the Broadcast.
Do that.
Which part of Scotland do you want? Edinburgh? Hello, hi, it's Patrick Doyle. You listen to Score the Podcast. And now let's come out of the show.
My face hurts.
I think that's the one.
That's Edinburgh. That's Edinburgh. I'll give you Inverness. Hello, it's Patrick Doyle here. You're listening to the Score podcast. And now let's go back to the show. This is me. This is Glasgow. Okay, here we go. You ready?
Yes.
Hi, this is Patrick Doyle. You're listening to Score, the podcast. And now let's go back to the show.
What, Patrick, one more time. I think you're a little hot on the mic, though. You're popping.
give us the FM DJ.
Okay. Hi. This is Patrick Doyle. You're listening to Score, the podcast. And now, let's go back to the show.
Oh, man. That was so good.
Oh, that deserves a round of applause.
He really is the best.
We're going to take a break, and if you enjoyed that, the interview is a lot of that. A lot of fun coming up with Patrick Doyle. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Blockbuster, the winner of Adweek's Creative Podcast of the Year, returns.
Film is a hobby, not a career.
I know, Dad.
James Cameron.
A movie for your ears.
James Cameron.
What, me? No.
This isn't what I envisioned.
It's a bad idea, okay?
About the world's most ambitious filmmaker.
It has to be perfect.
Just say, I'm the king of the world.
What? Why would I yell that?
Blockbuster. Get it wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Score fans, I'm just wondering if you have a favorite question you've been dying to ask us. You know, you could send it to us in an email. You send it to scorethemailbox@epiclef.com. That's EPICLEFF. Come up with a good question. Kenny or I will do our best to answer it. And if we don't know the answer, we may make one up, you know, just to keep the program rolling. Better yet, you could even record the question yourself and attach that to an email. Include your name and your location, and you just might make an appearance on this season of Score the Podcast.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Hi, this is Siddhartha Khosla. You're listening to Score, the podcast. And now let's go back to the show.
Welcome back to Score, the podcast presented by Spitfire Audio. So excited about our guest today. He makes his home there in Shepperton Studios in England, which we got a chance to visit when shooting Score, a film music documentary. He's known, of course, for his two Oscar-nominated films, Hamlet and Sense of Sensibility, for those scores, and also Golden Globe-nominated composer of Sense and Sensibility and Dead Again. Patrick Doyle, sir, how are you?
Oh, thank you. I built in on it.
We have a studio audience.
These people are so friendly. And,
they are lovely. They're expensive too. So
let's hope they're spaced safely.
Yes, they are 6 feet apart. Isn't that nice? That means there are thousands of them. Patrick, it's so nice not only to see you, of course, and see you again, but I'm reminded when we hear that you're at Shepperton Studios that I once came to visit you, and I thought about it. I think it was on Aragon, A lovely film about some fantasy dragon. And I came to Shepperton to visit you, and on that afternoon, the two other movies were being shot, and I was so excited. Obviously, I was excited to see you, but when we went outside, Pirates was being shot on some soundstage nearby, and Johnny Depp and his screen double were walking together, and I thought, that's perfectly odd. Two
Depp
Pirates.
And Depp. And
that's right, Depp and Depp. Depp 1 and Depp 2. Am I correct in remembering that there was a big 007 stage as
yes,
well?
Yes. We call it the 007 stage. I think it's one of the biggest stages in Europe. I'm not, I'm sure. I'm not sure America as well, but they can actually flood this stage and have you know, mock shipwrecks, etc. They used it on the film I did, Frankenstein, years ago. It was amazing to see all these actors getting drenched with gallons and gallons of fake seawater. It was unbelievable. It's a huge stage, but it's enormous.
I think in the United States, we don't hear a lot about Shepperton Studios. What can you tell our listeners about Shepperton? Is it the largest studio lot in Europe?
I'm not really sure. There's Pinewood Studios is a sister studio to Shepperton. There's Pinewood Studios and Shepperton Studios, and both have been facilities for making films for way back to the beginning of talkies. In fact, I forget his name, but the studios were actually founded by a Scotsman who I wish I remember his name now. He made a fortune on what they call the flick books, where you would flick a piece of a little book with a little animation changing drawer every time, and that's why they called it "Go to the Flicks." And he made a fortune selling these, and then with his passion for silent films that were just showing in little shorts at the time, he bought an enormous fancy country house and built, I think, 6 sound stages, and literally built it from scratch. So it was founded by a Scotsman, Shepperton and Pinewood Studios.
Very cool.
The lot used to be a lot bigger. It was a bit like the Fox Studios when they had masses of land before Century City was built. We had masses of land around it. In fact, they shot Oliver, the movie Oliver. And if you remember, Who Will Buy This Wonderful More, that whole enormous set with the Palladian houses, those London houses, those sort of Paddington houses, a whole semicircle of them. Well, they had that up here for years and years and years, and use it for all these central London scenes or movies, whatever. And then it was sold off in the 80s and asset stripped, sadly. It was bought very cheaply, and all this beautiful land was sold off. Now they're busting at the seams. Netflix have now taken over the studios.
Wow.
I think for the next 5 years, only Netflix are coming here for 5 years, and me.
Yeah, so the question is, how do you end up, because, you know, so many of the composers we've talked to, they either have studios at home or, you know, David Arnold is at Air Studios, but we don't talk to many composers who have a spot on a film lot. How do you end up on a film lot? And you've been there about 30 years, right?
I have. My very first film was Henry V, and they gave me a little portal cabin, and I scored it from there. And I never like to work at home. I rarely work at home. Maybe I'll try the odd thing out at the piano, but invariably I like to come to my work every single day. I come to the office every day, and I work, whether it's not in a movie, I work in my own projects. It's lucky I've been able to build a little fence around. There's now a little citadel. I've got tall trees, and I look out. All I see are trees now. I tend my geraniums and my plants out the back, and it's a little area that no one can find, like a secret garden in the middle of Shepperton Studios. So it's just evolved, and I'm sort of part of the woodwork. I'm sure they would like to get rid of me for the space, but.
I got nervous when you said Netflix has moved in. Would they say, who is the guy in the back with the geraniums? Do we need him?
What's with this nursery and this really funny guy out here?
Patrick, I want to know about that coming to work every day. I think that's incredible. I'd love to know, is there a specific time that you really clock in? I think young composers need to hear that this isn't a kind of wait till you're inspired gig. And do you come even when you are not in the heat of battle scoring a film? Do you still show up and just be there, or is it only when you're working on a film?
No, I'm here every day. Every day, Monday to Friday. If I can help it, I don't work Saturday and Sunday, if I can help it. But obviously, when things are crunchy and a movie that's changing all the time, then it spills into Saturday, but rarely, if ever, a Sunday. That's sacrosanct. I think the body needs a day to completely rest. The brain needs a day. So I come in every day, regardless of whether I'm actually working on a movie or not, because I've got a million ideas of my own, and I work. I've just recently written a piece for solo violin and orchestra that Maggie asked for, my agent, for an album. So I spent a couple of days on that. So that was set off, and then I'll get masses of projects of my own to work with. I did a concert in Celtic for Celtic Connections in Glasgow last January, and I wrote a Scottish overture. And a choral piece. I love coming here. I'm here by about 9:30. It's an hour later. I've worked out by the time I sit in traffic, it's easier just to wait till after 9 o'clock when all the schools go in. And then I can drive in very quietly. So I start at 9:30, and I usually leave any time between 5:30 and 6:30. And I have no lunch break as such. I just eat on the run, a bowl of soup or something.
Nice.
So, and the gang are the same. We all just eat on the run and get home early. So that's my routine, and it's as regular as clockwork it has been for 30 years.
It's clearly works. I just wonder, when you move into the studio to do Henry V, of course that was because your good friend Kenneth Branagh had... I remember you told me at one point, I'd love to hear, and I'm sure everyone else would like to hear, you were working on a play with him. Am I correct that he was, that you knew him from school?
Yeah,
that he asked you to work on a theatrical version of Henry V?
He played Henry V on stage, and I think he was the youngest Henry V in the Royal Shakespeare Company's history. He played that part at 21 years of age. I remember seeing him on television being interviewed at one of these chat shows. He asked me to come and join him as a composer, musical director on a production of Twelfth Night, Shakespeare's Twelfth Night at the Riverside Studios in Hammersmith. And from there, it was very well received. In fact, I co-wrote a song with Paul McCartney for that.
Oh, come on.
How about that?
Are you the fifth Beatle?
I am, but Paul keeps it quiet.
Is there any possibility we could hear that song one day and release it and say an undiscovered Beatles treasure?
It's a long story, but basically, at one point, before Kenneth Branagh knew me, he asked Paul McCartney if he would could give him a song or something to help promote this show, this new theatre company he had initiated, the Renaissance Theatre Company. He said, I'm really busy, and as you can imagine. But he gave him this song and said, this might be useful, I don't know. So anyway, when I was introduced to Ken, we met, and he asked me to do the music for the play, and then he said, we have this song by Paul McCartney, and I wonder if you would consider using it. And I said, in my youth, I said, in my arrogant way, I said, well, that's what I meant at the time. I said, well, only if it's appropriate.
Studio marketing divisions would love to hear that response.
You say, as a producer, and I'm thinking, I can't believe this guy just said this. But I was very sincere about it. So I went home and I opened the play. He gave me a book of the play. I mean, I knew the play anyway, but he gave me a copy of the production, the particular copy of the edition that he was using. And I opened the book, and it came to Festi's song, Come Away Death. And I just listened to the Paul McCartney song and I thought, oh my God, this is so bizarre. It scans with this poem, this song that Vessi sings. But I thought, but it needs a counter melody. So I wrote a counter melody on top of it over Paul McCartney's melody. And then I dropped one of the verses. I thought, now it fits to suit the theatre production. So then I phoned Ken up and I said, because immediately when I met Ken, it was something extraordinary. It was an instant sort of click went on between the two of us. I thought, my goodness, it's as if I've known this guy forever. So I called him up and I said, I've just looked at this, the play again, and I told him the story. So that was it. So when the program was put into, they put music by Patrick Doyle and Paul McCartney. So all the reviews, the show was a huge hit, And all the reviews say music by Doyle and McCartney. So
Doyle was first on that?
Yes.
Well, yeah. Because
Paul, John Lennon came looking for you. Well, Who is this guy?
The thing is with the billing, Paul only wrote one song. I wrote about 90% of the score. The phone rang. It was hot, the phone. I've just read, is this you? Yes, it is actually. but anyway, that's a long story. But that's when I first worked with Ken. Then I toured with him, and we toured with Hamlet, As You Like It, and Much Ado About Nothing, all three plays. And each of them were directed by Judi Dench, Derek Jacobi, and Geraldine McEwan. So we toured the whole of the UK and Northern Ireland. And then after that, we did a world tour, touring with King Lear and A Midsummer Night's Dream. And we played the Mark Taper Forum in downtown LA. We just happened to be in Los Angeles at the same time Henry V opened in Los Angeles, the film. So we were there doing a play, and I was doing... the film had just opened, so it was like a perfect storm for me in terms of helping my career to be launched. So it was one of those things that the gods all came in at their one time and said, all right, it's your turn.
And you had an instant connection with Ken, it sounds like. I mean, you said it, and it seems like those are hard to come by. Do you feel lucky that you found your director that soon, that right out of the gate like that?
Well, of course, it was my very first picture, and we've done about, I've forgotten about 13 films together. Maybe this is the 13th or the 14th, I can't remember. It was extraordinary. I met him very, I don't go to clubs or that kind of scene to network and all that stuff. It was never my scene to do that. But I went to see a production of Napoleon, a one-man show, with a mutual friend, John Sessions. And John Sessions is like a Robin Williams, a hilarious guy, hilarious. And he and Ken were rather together. So I went to see the show, it was extraordinary directing on Ken's part, and an extraordinary one-man performance by John. And I met him in the Zanzibar bar afterwards, and it was just a brief hello. And then I got a call, I met him at the Riverside, and it was instant. It was, he never even asked to hear any music. He just said, he immediately says, well, so when we do this and we do that, I thought, there's no sort of formal, you know, do you want to work in this? It was, and then we do this and then we do that, as if it was always going to happen. It was strange. And I suppose that's what he's like. He'll think, well, that person would be perfect for this. And then he has a discussion with them. And on that occasion, it was a foregone conclusion, obviously, on his part. And it was meant to be on mine. I thought, well, I reckon we're now working together. So, and that was it.
So Kenneth had been offered a film deal for Henry V, obviously, as a result of his work. And he turned to you and said, well, since you've done the music for the play, would you score the film? Had you scored a film?
No, it wasn't actually as simple as that. No, we were working together in the theatre, And I knew he was doing this film. Obviously, I heard he's working on this picture. So he had, he was busy just getting on with it. And I suppose he'd, I think he'd possibly approached another composer. I think a chap called Howard Blake, not a lovely guy, who wrote a film called the score for a film, very successful animation film called The Snowman. And Howard had said, no, he'd done enough work in films. He wanted to concentrate on a concert career. And that was a long time beforehand. So as to the composer on this upcoming film, he hadn't really thought about it. So that was the only time before and since that I lobbied to do a movie. I hustled to do that film. I was very nervous, very anxious about it, but I hustled. And I put him, I suppose, under a little bit of pressure because we got on so well, I suppose, and he's a very loyal chap. So the producer, I played some thematic ideas I had for it, and he responded very well to that. And then they gave me some money for a demonstration tape, a demo. Now, this is before samples, modern samples, but we had I was introduced to a guy who had a Fairlight, the early computer, this enormous thing, and I mocked up the non nobis domini from the picture, and also what ended up being the opening title, and both of these were written with just descriptions in mind, without seeing any film.
Oh, it wasn't written to picture.
No, and they both are exactly as they were written and fitted to the picture. So this was my first score, and my life was consumed with terror.
And that film yielded the scene that someone we both worked with, who was my boss at that time, Tom Rothman, would always point to, the big epic speech in Henry V and Patrick Doyle's cue, and say, whatever movie we were working on, if we were working on an animated picture about little kitty cats, and there was a moment where it was somehow the triumphant moment, the boss would say, I want it to sound like Patrick Doyle's cue in Henry V, because it was the incredible example of heroism.
Patrick, I'm curious, when you said, you lobbied to score this film, did you have any idea about the inner workings of the verbiage, the whole beast that is scoring a film? I mean, obviously you were qualified for the music, but did you have any idea what you were getting into, and how did you adapt to all of that?
I had no idea whatsoever. No idea. There was no music editor. I didn't know that such a thing existed. And I had no idea how to put music to film. I was improvising. I have a fairly good piano technique, so I'd be improvising on a very early sampled synthesizer with just strings. That'd be my mock-up. This is a string sample. And I would demonstrate that to Ken for ideas. But one day I realized, well, I was told by an orchestrator that this will not fit to the picture. What you're playing is, as soon as we sit down to play that, it will not fit. It has to be to the frame and the second. And I says, well, how the do I do that? He says, well, you'll need the Carl Knudsen book. And I says, who the hell is Carl Knudsen? He said, music editor. I said, oh, just, and he goes, I said, so he handed me this book. I don't know if you've seen it. This thing is like logarithms. It's like trigonometry. I thought, for a person who was useless at maths, I nearly headed for the Severn Bridge or the San Francisco Bridge. I thought, this is a nightmare. What was? And of course, I'm saying nothing. I'm blagging it. I'm going, yes, fine. It's all kind of like, you know, smoke and mirrors. It's no problem. I'm thinking, oh my God, this is a nightmare. So I made him sit down. I said, show me how to use this, you know, bloody thing, you know. So he sat down and he explained it to me. And I thought, oh my God, I get this. This is, you know, going from one tempi to the other and stopping. And he said, you have to plot the entire thing out in advance, whether you're using 4/4 bars, 6/4 bars, you work out your tempi, everything else. So it was a crash course in one day. And I mean this, in fact, one morning, I said, you're not leaving here till you show me how this flaming boot works. And I thought, now, of course, I've got this. Then I would spend 3 or 4 hours every day mapping out these things before I wrote a note. So I worked out the entire, I improvised, that's worked out the entire cue. Then I would map it out to, fortunately, I had a locked picture. Fortunately, the picture was locked and locked for months. So, and there was no studio breathing down our necks, you know, about changing the lock. So that was it. So I had this luxury of a locked picture. So then I very quickly got to grips with it. And then the music began to pour out because I wasn't bogged down with the terror and the technicalities. And then I would have to write in every 3 or 4 bars, you know, after 1.4 seconds we are at the shot. I put the marking of, you know, what was happening on the picture and everything else. So that was the process. That's how I learned to write to picture. And the irony was, when we got to the recording session, Sir Simon Rattle, who conducted, that's another story, when he conducted it was his first film, he said, this is matching so beautifully to the film that he threw away the cans and conducted it wild.
Amazing.
He didn't use any click for the entire. So months of hell in my part were a waste of time. So in fact, he did what the orchestrator says was impossible. He did it. He got it. And Simon came down to my studio at one point. I was so nervous. He's such an illustrious, you know, figure and musician. Mm-hmm. He was so great. He was so unpretentious and still is unpretentious. Anyway, he was so into it and so generous. He said, Patrick, I don't need your click. You know, with all due respect, it's all fit in this dialogue. I know exactly what you're, and it's all, you've given me instructions on the, I can see where the, you know, explosion here, horse comes into view, dialogue there, and the music. That's all I need. And without any clock, and he conducted that picture. So it's an extraordinary event, the entire thing. For your first film, it was like, and I was like, it was almost as if I was on, if you can imagine, I was on top of a fountain and I was being injected and it didn't come down for months, you know. I thought, every day something more amazing happened. It was this whirlwind of wondering what I'm going to do with my life to, I can't deal with this. It was a tsunami of changing events by the second. So it was an extraordinary time.
That must have been a huge confidence boost for you, though, once you started figuring it out. Just an overnight change, because most people spend sometimes years learning this and apprenticing and stuff like this. But for you to learn on the fly like that, did you feel pretty confident moving into your next film? Like, I got this now?
Well, fortunately, technically, the next film I did was a film for Disney. And by then, computers had arrived in with music editors suddenly had computers that would print out I would give them all the instructions, and the computer would print all that pre-recorded blank sheet of music out. So it did all that donkey work. So that all that work was eradicated overnight. That was my second film. So fortunately,
what was the film?
It was a film with Shipwright in America, and it was called Håkon Håkonsson in Norway. It's a Norwegian, very famous Norwegian story. To this day, when I listen to it, I think, oh, my God, I can't believe it. There are 1,000,000,000 notes every 5 minutes. I have so much to prove. Can you imagine a pirate movie, an action movie? It was extraordinary. I don't know how I did it looking back at it. I don't know where I got the energy. It was extraordinary. Looking back in that school, it's terrifying. The page is black. You know, it's all handwritten. I couldn't do it now. I couldn't do it now. It's too exhausting, all that. Too exhausting.
I heard you in an interview say, actually, that when you used to have to handwrite scores, you would have to go on a vacation afterward. But now that computers are around, you can go from score to score.
Yeah. It's a breeze. The whole thing about what happens when you start to write, one goes into an alpha state when when one composes, you do go into a kind of a really heightened state of concentration. And things happen within that after you come out of it and you think, where did that come from or whatever? But when you write it by hand, that is multiplied 50 times. And it just seems to eat into your brain in terms of your fatigue level and all your energy. And yes, I would often have to go away for, I couldn't go from one project to the other. I did have to have time off. And we're very fortunate we have this house in France. We didn't at this point, but now, halfway through the first half of my career, I would go away and spend, you know, a week just staring at a wall, not doing anything, like a Japanese, sort of, you know, stone garden. Yeah. I mean, the kids laugh and say, "Oh, Daddy's looking at the wall again." So I literally just, I can be, you know, full of inertia and full of energy, you know, from one, you know, moment to the next. So I still do that to a degree. I am very, very generous with my holidays, and my downtime. When I'm working here, I work. But when I go on holiday, I can go away for weeks at a time and not do anything.
I think that's great. And I think it's admirable and required. You know, we all have to refresh. I mean, some of the work, one of the best things that this interview has done for me is I've had the opportunity to be reminded why you have always been one of my favorites. I went and listened to so many of the scores, Sense and Sensibility and Dead Again. And then I got to some of my Gosford Park. And what's interesting to hear these stories is I hear an evolution also with electronics.
Yeah.
Because there must have been, of course, a moment where your incredible orchestral facility, which is just insanely gorgeous. I mean, we did Great Expectations together, and I went back and listened to it. And that's one of my favorite themes, the Great Expectation theme. It's Kissing in the Rain or Kissing in the Dark or something. I just loved it. But then as we continued to work together, there was the incorporation of electronics. And I don't know if there's a particular score where you realized – I have to actually use electronics as an instrument now instead of just samples. Do you remember what score was the pivot point and how it changed things?
Well, there was a major sort of flip because I knew that the phone rang on four different occasions and I was asked to do four movies one after the other, and each one I had to turn down because I wasn't mocking up pictures. The producers were very blunt and said, "Well, if you don't mock up, Patrick, you can't work on a project." And I thought, things have changed dramatically. So I thought, all right, okay, so I'm going to have to buy computers. And for a man who couldn't even email or type, bizarre for a pianist. So this was a terrifying prospect. I thought, oh, dear. Because the old adage, adapt or die, is the case. And I always think of the great composer Handel. You know, when opera wasn't fashionable, get the oratorios down there, you know. So he completely kind of like swapped to sort of feed the market what was. And I thought, well, I have to embrace this technology. So I bought it and it sat for the box and gear sat for about 9 months. Come on, open me up. And I was like, oh, no, it's terrible. I don't know what to do. I didn't know anyone who could help me with this stuff. Anyway, eventually we got a young person to come along and we opened up the box, took it out and started the process. And that was for Nanny McPhee. It was in Logic. So a few of the cues were in Logic. A lot of the cues were handwritten. So it was a real hybrid moment in the score. You can see, I've still got all these scores. You can see the transition. And then Harry Potter came. And it suddenly became a lot more of electronics for Harry Potter. But still, I was thinking symphonically. And a few of the cues in Harry Potter were written totally by hand. When Cedric dies, that's all done by hand. And the very last cue of the movie, all done by hand. Wow. And I remember I wrote them in France, those last cues. And I remember coming at the point I didn't have a proper studio at the time, and I was working in the garage, makeshift in the garage, and the doors were open. And I come out at the end of the day, and I'd forgotten what it was like to write by hand. And my head needed bled. It was bursting. I thought, oh, my God, I just can't do this anymore. This other stuff is so, it's just an incredible, it's like a power tool. After you've been screwing in nails, you've got a power that drills in the nails. You think, what about, you know, those guns as well for staples,
right?
Rather than hand done, though, that kind of speed at which people put on a roof, you know, the cladding in a roof, you watch it, kling, 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 kling. It's a bit like that. You know, the work's not diminished because you still have the background. It was just something I would say, okay, now the assistant I have. The programmer will. I'll say, okay, give us a string pad, right? Give us a string. Okay, individually, I'll, you know, and I'll say, give us some horns, and then I'll orchestrate as I go along. And of course, he will ease the sounds, and you know, so they've got crescendos and diminuendos and everything else, and you know, ralentandos or ternandos, you know. So all it was just having this amazing tool, amazing Black & Decker, to. You know, to speed up the process rather than killing yourself by hand. You know, you can just play at a run, you know, up and down octaves. You can double up the flutes, double that with, you know, the clarinets or whatever, you know, and I'll put a bed of horns underneath that. And suddenly, you know, I couldn't get it down fast enough. So I'm very grateful, you know, for this change in many ways. And then I suppose Thor was the big sort of computer one that with a symphony orchestra, and that that was the first time I worked on that kind of massive franchise. And apart from Porter, it was different Porter, but the Marvel label was something else. That's a whole machine that's sort of, you have to be, as Ken says, it's like being asked to come in and redesign the McDonald's sign, but don't change the M. You know, but you still got to come in and actually put your thing in there. So you've got to squeeze yourself in this huge machine that's absolutely this big juggernaut, that this is the way we do it. I remember the Q, which in fact is the end Q, the end title Q in Thor. That's the first piece I wrote as a standalone sort of demo. And, you know, and I used this huge, big, broad chords with these incredible drums and everything else, and this da 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 da, those kind of, you know, little those kind of ostinato figures. I thought I would have that device throughout this entire piece, and all the harmonies would grow around it. And I sent that off to the folk at Marvel after Ken said, "This is great, just send it to them." So I sent it to them, they got excited, and although it was never used in that form, they were so great. They loved it so much, they gave it, you know, they said, please put it at the end title and that'll see us off. So that was the first film. And I did get some comments, people saying, oh my God, I was astonished you did that picture. It was you who did that picture. So a lot of people were surprised and said, I didn't expect you to be doing such a electronic score and sort of rock and roll, symphonic rock and roll.
Does it? Sorry. I was just going to ask, you seem to be very musical with your singing, and we know you're a singer. How does that help you when you're presenting ideas to producers or directors? Do you sing a lot for them, or do you mostly play?
Well, when I'm writing a song, I'll sometimes record it myself. In fact, invariably, I will record it myself. I'll either put on a voice or sing it in my own singing voice. But I come from a singing family. I come from an astonishing array of great singers, not just good.
And you've made a couple too in your house. I know that you have some beautiful singers.
Yes, absolutely. My two daughters are fabulous singers, and they're not interested in doing it professionally. One of them works for Simon Cowell, ironically. She's an international vice president for international for Britain's Got Talent and the X Factor abroad, the whole world, and she's a better singer than half the singers on this show, and she's and she's not interested. But she's sung in movies for me as a favor. So, and sometimes the demos. She worked with Robert Altman at 19. She co-wrote a song with Robert on Gosford Park. She sang two songs on it, and she faked one of the songs, but she put on this sort of sultry sort of cabaret Weimar Republic voice and sang the song. And Robert says, "I love that. We'll keep that." I said, "But that's fake. No, it sounds real to me. We'll keep that." You know, she was 19.
Do you ever sing on your scores? Have you ever made an appearance?
Yes, I sung not anymore, but I sung on Much Ado About Nothing and on As You Like It and Henry V. I'm the soldier who sings No Nobis Domine Domine, No Nobis Domine, Sed Nomini, Sed Nomini, Tuod a Gloria. You know, so I still...
Can we have some applause for that? I just wonder, did Paul McCartney call you and say, "Listen, can you open for the Beatles?"
I must say, I do love singing it, and I've studied it, and the family. I say my two daughters are both fabulous singers. We did a concert, two concerts last January. One was the first live performance of Brave. At the concert hall in Glasgow, and also the following Thursday night, that was on the Saturday and Sunday, and the following Thursday night, which is an evening of my music, and part of that was my two daughters singing. One sang a song from Into the West, a movie I did in Irish Gaelic, and Nuala, my daughter, sang the song from the entitled song from Murder on the Orient Express, We Will Never Forget You. Also that evening, I took an old recording of my father, who had died, unfortunately, although at a great age, 96, he died, nearly 97, he died a year before, that was 2 years ago. I took a recording of his, and I cleaned it up, and then we played the recording live with the BBC Symphony Orchestra.
What? That's awesome.
Now, that was unbelievable. And I'm not making this up. Everybody in the orchestra, even the hard-bitten brass players, were all wiping their eyes, you know. And the conductor, Dirk Rossi, was like, everyone was like, "I have to put myself together." And I'm not joking, because everyone has a father, and whether you love your father, you didn't love your father, or you can't live without your father, or, you know, everyone's father was a huge part of their lives, is a huge part of their lives. And he had an astonishing voice and never ever sang with an orchestra. That was his dream. Or solo with an orchestra. He sang on the choir, on Henry V in the Non Nobis Domini. And I have a video of my dad with cans on with Simon Rattle. It's very, very...
Really?
Freaky. Yeah, I have a video, home video of that. I have a few home videos of the whole Non Nobis tracking shot and the filming of it. So he never ever sang solo with an orchestra. So this was an extraordinary, the audience went crazy. They just loved it because it's a really world-class voice he had. It wasn't just like, "Well, that was very pleasant." That was like, what are we talking about here? We're talking about Pavarotti or that kind of voice, you know.
That is great.
So it was a wonderful moment. I mean, looking back in it, good old Will, he pressed the button in time. And the recording, there was no problem with the recording. So it was a treat, actually.
We have so much more to get to with Patrick. We want to take a quick break. Stick around. We'll be right back.
Hey there, fans of Score the Podcast. I'm David W. Collins, creator and host of The Soundtrack Show for iHeartRadio. Like you, I love Score the Podcast. And The Soundtrack Show is the perfect complement if you're passionate about music for film, TV, even video games and theater. Each week, I do a deep dive into some of the greatest scores of all time, as well as some fan favorites. and talk about why the music moves us from a character and story point of view. We also learn fascinating behind-the-scenes stories and share the history and background that brought each piece of music to life. It doesn't matter if you're a musician or not. Music is a language that we all understand. And through our love of movies like Star Wars, Lord of the Rings, Back to the Future, or even classics like Casablanca or Psycho, we can gain a deeper appreciation for how composers are speaking to us through music, explaining why we have such a powerful reaction to the images on screen. The Soundtrack Show is available on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is Stephen Price. You're listening to Score the Podcast. Let's get back to the show.
All right, we have a little treat for you here, Patrick.
Okay.
I got a cookie for you. Welcome back to Score the Podcast, presented by Spitfire Audio. That is the story that we made famous last year on the show. I got a cookie for you. And we have the composer here to tell us all about the moment. Patrick Doyle, Rise of the Planet of the Apes, stuck on a queue, looking at cookies. And the video, is incredible of the scoring session. But what do you remember about the struggles of the cookie?
Well, the thing is, the cookie was that really was the kind of, what would you call it? The cookie was the epitome of the entire experience of the film. It was one of those films that, and it happens, it just goes in one direction, the wrong direction, the score, right? And then there's shock and horror when people eventually turn away from a thousand other pictures and turn around and say, what is this? All these demos, the whole film was demoed. And I was thinking, this is going in the wrong direction, I fear. But my loyalty is to the director at all times. And will remain so. But it became apparent to him and myself at this stage when the studio threw their hands up in horror and said, what is this? The score was in danger. I have to be honest, the score was in danger. And a certain man called Robert Kraft, and along with some very, very good friends at Fox, said, whoa, I would just give this guy maybe another look at this, you know, and tell him what you want before it ends up, you know, in, you know, the drop score hell box. So of which I am eternally grateful, like I said, here we are, for the record, for all your listeners, the man is sitting, you know, through the Zoom world in front of me. And it was great, because to cut a long story short, I took a call from Robert and various people, and then we had a call with all the executives at the top, including Rupert. And I said, okay, tell me what you want, all right? They told me what I want. And I jumped on a plane the following morning. This is a real Hollywood story. I jumped on a plane the following morning, and because I'm working, they said, do you want to have a go? I said, sure. No one's taking this away from me. I want my ass off for this. Sorry, I want my butt off for this. So I jumped on the plane the following day, and I rethought the entire score based on the notes. I sort of knew the score I wanted to write anyway all along. So when we arrived, then we, if you remember, Robert, we all came and we had a spotting session. And the main theme, I remember, I was sitting, you'll be verifying this, the main theme, ba, 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 one of the main themes, ba, ba, da, dee, dee, da, ba, 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 da, right, was composed in front of this room full of people. It's not the first time I've done this. About eight people in the room, and I sang it down, just because it was handy, I sang it into a phone, and it was sent to my assistant in London, and he wrote it in manuscript and sent it back. So we had it printed back in about 10 minutes or 5 minutes. That became one of the main themes in the film. It was 2 weeks of they flew the crew over, my team from London flew us over. I said to them, okay, I've got the brief of the film. Nobody talked for 2 days. Do exactly as I say. Do exactly as I say. There's no discussion. There's no collaboration. Do exactly as I say, right? I know exactly what they want, okay? And on day three, then you can question things, okay? Right? Okay. And that's exactly what happened. So on the third day, then we got up at seven. We got up at six. We start work at seven, and we stop at 11, and we eat and we sleep at 12. So we'll have 6 hours a day sleep. No all-nighters, and put us all up in the Intercontinental Hotel right next to Fox. You gave us my equivalent of here in Fox Studios, and I think we were the first composer to work on the lot for about 30 years or something. So it was perfect. I was at home there, right next to the studio, straight off the computer, straight into the record. And lo and behold, that was the first time I heard the expression, you've gone from zero to hero.
That's it.
I never heard that expression before, and I thought, that's very apt. You know, and as you can verify, we had a ball. Anyway, the cookie, that scene, that particular scene, because I'm rewriting the whole score, probably 50% of it was rewritten. A lot of it was fine. But when it came to that blooming cue, I kept looking and said, what the hell? What is this scene? And was this about, it's about sort of collectivity and the group and connecting through this given a cookie, right? And I thought, what did I do here, right? And everything they tempted with was, never tried, I thought. And then I suddenly thought, and I looked at me, I've got a cookie for you. And I thought, oh, that's it. Surely not. Surely that's not it. You know, I just started goofing around with it. And that was it. So we put, give us this rhythm, you know, all these kind of earthy instruments and samples and stuff. I went, I've got a cookie for you. And then, of course, and all the orchestration came and everything else. And then I remember playing, and I remember Robert, you come round like this, but you're, your eyes, a big smile on your face. And do you remember the day, Robert, as well? I've been trying to write this climbing up the tree cue. It was driving me insane, right? And that wasn't happening. And River didn't like it. And, you know, and then everyone was sitting there. You remember this day? And I said, right, keep that drum beat going, right? From the cue that no one likes. Get rid of everything. Give me a string pad, right? Okay. Put the cue up, right? Okay, I'm going to improvise this entire thing. I'm going to play to picture. Grab this, okay? So I literally started, and you'll verify this, I played, improvised the entire cue to for watching the whole scene like I used to do 30 years ago, like a silent movie pianist in a film, in an old film, silent film studio or theatre years ago. And then, because I've been living with this scene for so long, I'm just going back to my own instinct, the way I used to always work. And everyone went, we love it. We love it. That was it.
Patrick is too modest here, because what I'm realizing and remembering is I saw true movie magic in front of me a couple times when you sang that first cue. And I remember the whole room just lit up. It's like, well, that's it. I mean, also, when you played the tree cue and everyone said, okay, that's done. I mean, it was just so lovely. And I would always want to say, you realize you just saw genius at work in real time. This wasn't somebody who's just sort of, you know, agonizing over something. He's actually feeling the scene and writing the music. But I do want to add the thing that I always took away and I now teach, which is the film that you saw of Planet and the Apes when you were in the UK and we were in LA was a film of guys with little dots all over their body and body microphones, yeah, and body cams. It was the pre-special effects version, yeah, of all the apes with their CGI,
yeah,
high-tech information on that was going to be transformed into fur and, yes, faces of apes, and you wrote to that. Mm-hmm. And I remember the feeling or something that you said at one point, which is that one of the transformations that took place was here when you finally saw the full on, I am Caesar.
Yes.
You know, the full on ape. You thought, oh my goodness, there's too much something in the music, and I don't remember what it was, drama or overcompensation for all the electronics. You've got to change the score and dial it down, which you did in 2 weeks. And I think what you've omitted from the story is we were on a incredibly high pressure clock.
Yeah.
The movie, it was one of those situations that you hear about where bus shelters around Los Angeles had coming May 4th, Rise of the Planet of the Apes. And this was like April 2nd.
Yeah.
And you had to deliver, and we had a score date. So you had to write all, I've got a cookie for you. You know, I remember you said that it was the night before, or two nights before, the actual recording session.
Yes, yes.
So you delivered.
And the thing is about that cue in particular, that cue was just perfect for that. There was no other cue. There was no other music in the world would have done the job other than that. That was what that cue needed. I mean, the process was agonizing, but fortunately, having worked in theater for 10 years, theater is full of last minute dramas and fires. So I come from a family of 13, and every day was the opening of a movie. And I'm not joking. It was a drama every day in our house. There was always somebody losing their finger, getting run over by a car, getting mauled by a dog. And I'm absolutely not making this up. It was crazy. I lived in chaos. To this day, the kids can, well, not either, too, but when they were young, they would play ball all around me, and I could compose, and it wouldn't bother me. But the minute I heard a rhythm, I would say, stop that noise. But chaos, loud noise. So as you remember, the sessions, there were 50 people came to the last sessions. In that recording session, 50 people came as guests. It was like a party. So I sort of thrive on that kind of drama, but with the caveat that all the thought processing about what this film was done over almost a year. So it was all in there. I just knew with this new direction, which made total sense to me, this is, you know, but you're right. If you can't see the film, you can make some kind of leap, quantum leap, but until you see them all with all the, you know, rendered and everything else, it's becomes something else. And often less is more. So you start.
That's the lesson that you taught me on that, which is the less is more lesson. You made a remark once, which I always thought about, which is that you felt that it was too dramatic, the music. Once you saw the pictures, the monkey spoke so much in their visual presentation, their final presentation, that you didn't have to write as
but
much.
See that's the danger. That's the danger of working too early. It is difficult for composers working too early on a picture because this leap of imagination that you inject is very often overcompensating for we haven't got the proper visual effects, we haven't got the proper sound effects. And very often, if the sound department are a bit slow in providing all the sounds, you're overcompensating for sounds that are going to come eventually. But I spent 2 days in that. It's completely unnecessary. So if you can hold off as long as possible, but do as much preparation as possible until as much of it comes in that you say, I know where we are, then you learn by it. But you know, shocks and surprises come up on every picture. I mean, that was one picture certainly with your help. I felt like Popeye clinging onto the ship as the ship was on a motorboat as it was flying off, and he's determined to get back on it again behind the wheel. So I wasn't going to let that film go. There's some films I've done my bit. No way. Because I love the story. I thought it looked amazing. And I said to Tom Rothman, I said, Tom, this film is going to be amazing. And he wasn't sort of sure at one point. You know, he's under huge pressure. And he's juggling a million pictures, as all these heads of studios are. But he very, very kindly sent me a lovely post. I have it just behind that door. And it's a picture of Andy Serkis during the advertising campaign, they had this poster that went from his face to the ape's face to Caesar's face.
I remember that.
Yeah, as you looked at one angle. So he sent me that, and he signed the bottom and says, "Dear Patrick, you were right, Tom."
That's great.
Well, I think we also have to give a shout out to our great mutual friend, Ted.
Ted Galliano, yes.
Because Ted was the one who was in that meeting. I don't know if you're fully aware of this, where we all looked at the music you had sent, the demos, and the director looked, I would say, suicidal would be the upside of how he looked. And Ted and I walked out together, and Ted said, "Call Patrick and tell him he should be here tomorrow." And I thought, oh, that seems really kind of over the top. I mean, can't we just have – and Ted said, you know, he has to come. He has to come to L.A. right away and sit with the director. He'll get this right, but you need him in the room. And I remember I went back to my office and called you, and you said, "I'm on the next plane."
Yeah.
And that saved it. And I thought it sounded incredibly dramatic, and you were incredibly calm.
Yeah, sure. I was. I am. I can honestly say that I was brought up in mayhem. You know, every day was mayhem. Millions of people in the house. I sort of can look through this kind of miasma of kind of, and I can focus on things. I thrive on big crowds. You know, it's the kind of person I thrive on 1,000 people around here. You know, so, you know, and it's almost like, I don't know, you become like a circus, you know, a circus, the guy who's the guy.
Yeah, the ringmaster.
Especially when you know, I thought, this is a great briefing. This is a great new briefing. I know exactly what to do here. I know exactly what to do. So just tell me what you want. You want blue, red, yellow, or green. What do you want? Do you want strings? Do you want this? Do you want that? Solid direction, and you're off. Plus, it's a great picture, and it stands up to this day. It's a wonderful thing. So, but yes, without Ted Galliano's support, your support, and, you know, there are always mates in these situations who see the bigger picture, pardon the pun, and know that certain people, no, this is to do with direction and to do with redirection. The cliche is knowing the process. When people know the process, they can say, "Look, I know where you're driving, going with that. Don't go there. Don't go here." I remember working with Mark Andrews on Brave, and Mark would go, he's like so infusive. You know, he would say, I love it. You know, this bit's great. That's too fast. I want it like this. You go, okay, great, got it. Okay, that was it. You would do it. Next thing you go, I love it. Okay, and it was like, boom, boom, boom. Absolute, this is what I want. This is what we need. And I mean, when someone's coming up with a highly intelligent alternative to your idea, then you go with that. That's called collaboration, you know, because you're contributing and throwing things in with inhibition. We love that. People don't want to be dragging everything out of you. They want your contribution. And then go, "Well, look, what about that?" Because that's, I see in terms of the arc of the story, you're right. You know, I'm too focused at this moment, but that will pay off there. Absolutely right. So it's a wonderful collaboration. And generally speaking, that's how it is. But some films like that, you just know this is going in the wrong direction, and it's not coming back. it's getting beyond me. I'm like a voice going, "No, I don't think so. This isn't right." But anyway, so it worked out well.
Patrick, you mentioned Brave, and first off, we're curious, were you brought onto the film because of your Scottish roots? Did that play a role in it? And you also voiced a character in the film. Were you... Are you an actor? I know that we saw a credit of you with Chariots of Fire, and we wanted to try and find it. Were you in Chariots of Fire?
Where do you guys find this stuff? Yes, I was in the film Chariots of Fire, and the only clip they ever show of it, I'm the only person who speaks. It's when, if people who know the film, the guy runs, Eric Little runs, and he falls and gets up and still wins the race. It's unheard of. And it cuts to the crowd, and I play this character who's like a bookie's mate, like a betting guy's assistant, a little runner. And I've got this sort of 1920s cap on, and I think. And it cuts to me, and I say, "You'll never do it." "You'll never do it."
You saved the picture.
Or he'll never make it. Or he'll never make it. Or something. He'll never make it. So this cut to me. So anyway, so the only clip they ever show is that. In fact, they showed it when it was shown at the Oscars. They showed that clip. My brother phoned from Holland and he goes, "I've just seen you in Chariots of Fire. What the hell? Get on." That's only a small part of my huge role. And that was it.
And that was your first acting Oscar that you won, right?
Yeah, well, yes. I avoided crowds after that. I became Greta Garbo. I thought, no, I can't take the limelight's too much for me.
Absolutely.
No, it was fun. It was great fun. And in fact, I was wondering, there was a lot of people I know whose performances, entire performances, ended up on the cutting room floor. So I was lucky to have one line in it. Kev Branagh was in the movie as a young actor. He was cut from it. So, seriously.
Brave was with Emma, who was, you knew, of course, through, I want to be delicate about this, she had been with your great friend and
they were
the director.
Married. Yeah, Kelly and Emma were married. And,
when you did Brave, were they still together or did
No, they weren't together then. I met Emma long before I met Kenneth Branagh. When I was an actor, I was working in Leicester Haymarket Theatre in the studio doing a play by a great friend of mine, a playwright and artist called John Byrne. And Emma was in the main theatre doing Me and My Girl, the musical, and we all got to know each other in the bar and became great friends. And this was long before she was, the sort of international star that she is now. So we're both sort of unknowns, and that's the best time to meet people when you're all just sort of forging your way through things. And then when I hooked up with Ken, he coincidentally started a relationship with Emma, and I already knew her. So I was friends with them on a sort of individual way. It was great. So it was perfect match, the whole thing. And I've still remained great friends with them both. I've learned this: when people, for whatever reasons, separate and go their separate ways, that's their business. And one keeps well out of it, especially when you love both characters. So, both people. Yes, she was on Brave. So it was great to work with her. And I wrote the song, which my son Patrick, who's now a film composer, Patrick Neal, he wrote the words to the song, which were translated into Gaelic, Noble Maiden Fair. So I composed it for Peggy, the young girl, and Emma. So and we worked together at the recording session. So it was delightful.
It's lovely.
Wonderful.
And they asked you to voice a character?
Well, yes. They named him Kevin. And I have three lines and a snore. At the end of the movie, there's the little thing they have during the end titles, just before the film, the roller stops.
I wonder if anybody who saw Brave stood up in a movie theater somewhere in the world and said, "I know this voice from Chariots of Fire. I think it's the same guy."
Well, that agent,
you'll never do it.
The one line agent is still chasing me. No, they were very nice, actually. They knew I'd done some acting away in the past, and they gave me a few lines in it, they took me. There's quite a ceremony takes place. It's wonderful. They walk you like royalty to this board, and on the board in one of the corridors, there's all every actor who's ever voiced a Pixar movie signs this board.
So I was
up there with all these amazing actors, Tom Hanks. I was like, wow, this is unbelievable. And I said, "What's my character's name?" He said, "He's no one refers to him, but he's called Kevin."
Kevin Doyle.
That's great.
Your question was, actually, it's one of those funny stories in Hollywood, or anywhere, in fact, but it's kind of funny, but in Hollywood, they'll sometimes ask a Greek composer to do an Irish picture, or an Irish composer to do a Greek picture. And this time they've got a Scotsman to write a quintessentially Scottish score for a Scottish subject.
It is quintessentially Scottish.
Scottish.
Also.
also, absolutely. And I thought, this is fantastic. I was so chuffed, as they say in Scotland. I was so pleased they did this. I thought, great, that part of the got right is wonderful. And then, we were about 3 or 4 months into the process, and I said to the director, producer, I said to Catherine, and and Brenda, I said, thank you very much, by the way, for this gig. This is a wonderful experience. And, you know, I told them the whole business of getting a Scottish composer for a Scottish subject. And they both went quiet and they looked at each other and they looked at me and said, actually, we had no idea you were Scottish.
Oh, my God.
How does somebody not know you're Scottish by talking to you?
They just didn't know. They said, but we just love your music. And they said, the fact you're Scottish,
that
we thought,
perfect.
And they thought, oh, my God, this is amazing. He's actually Scottish. I mean, so the gods were aligning there, you know. I thought it was cute. I thought it was really nice. I couldn't care less. I thought it was just funny. And they were very honest and lovely people. So
that's just perfect. That's Hollywood 101.
It's perfect.
You made all these assumptions, and none of them are correct.
Yeah, they're correct.
Patrick, we can't leave real quick without asking you about Harry Potter. Obviously, you came into the Harry Potter franchise with big shoes to fill after 3 John Williams films. I'm curious, did you ever speak to John when you started on the project, or how do you follow John Williams and knock it out of the park? It seems like a big ask.
Well, it was a tremendous honor to follow in his footsteps, and of course, his tremendous reputation, it goes, you know, before him, I suppose in a way, when I did Henry V, I followed in the footsteps of William Walton. So I'd already been there with a sort of a highly successful composer, and I felt, you know, there was no point in me worrying about it. We never met, actually. I've never met John. I've been at various award ceremonies and I've seen him around, but we've never been introduced. So when the opportunity came up to do it, he wasn't available. I thought, well, I mustn't fret about this. I must give it my best. And it's a director I've worked with before, Mike Newell. I did 2 films, Donnie Brasco and Into the West with Mike. So I knew I'd be in very safe hands, and I knew he would do a fantastic job. And he allowed me to, you know, to give it my own voice. And it was a brand new deal in that it was a whole new producer and director and everything else. And also the story shifts quite dramatically in terms of the age of these young people. They're mature, they're growing into adulthood. There's a sort of love element. Voldemort's character becomes far more prominent and dominant, that story. And Moody's character is a huge role, a huge part to play in it. And obviously I was delighted to use John's theme, the Hedwig theme. But I had the audacity to change the harmonies underneath it. and I hope he didn't mind that because I felt that it was a darker story. The chords had to do slightly different things underneath the theme. And I remember the recording session as they were playing it, the orchestra were kind of like, their eyes were sort of slightly cross-eyed as they were playing it. And I said, carry on, it's correct. The harmonies are correct. Don't worry about it, the harmonies are correct. Okay, you know. That's a D flat to an A flat in the middle of it all. It's sort of slightly crunchy, but it kind of resolves to
it worked.
So anyway, it was a tremendous honor. It's an incredible sort of phenomenon, the entire thing. So I'm very grateful to him. I'm very grateful to the filmmakers for giving me this wonderful opportunity, and Justin Fear, who conducts it along with other composers all over the world. We were there with the family, the Albert Hall, a packed house. What more do you want in your career? All of us composers having our works performed, if we're lucky enough, with the Philharmonia in London, you've got the Albert Hall, you're in a box, and with your family and your friends, and this incredible experience of live. And that was always my dream. Right from the very, because coming from theatre, I thought, why don't we have contemporary pictures with the music against the film, as opposed to these silent movies that was all the rage with Carl Davis, which were great. So that has come to fruition, and it's fantastic. I think it's a wonderful thing. This art form is still developing, and I've always felt this. We were the sort of the Cinderella of the classical music world. Not anymore. Mm-hmm. Actually, in many ways, the classical music world is really, really suffering badly, retaining audiences, sponsorships. I'm really fret for it. They're having to really reinvent themselves and sort of join the zeitgeist in this whole new world that's out there. So, and to be part of that, I'm extremely, extremely fortunate.
And interestingly enough, one of the ways they are reinventing is to bring live to picture film concerts back into those auditoriums, if we sure. ever get back there, and sure. playing film scores. I just wish I was a fly on the wall when they had that moment where they realized John Williams isn't available, and they fretted about the possibility that do you think we can get Patrick Doyle? He's the only other person we can go to.
Patrick, do you have any plans for future concerts? I know that we're in a weird state right now, but are you going to join that crowd?
Well, there's one plan. There's one planned in November with the RTE Orchestra in Dublin, and I'm not sure. Well, fingers crossed. I'm not sure. And there's a performance of the Goblet of Fire planned in Rochester with the Rochester Symphony Orchestra in September, and I'm not sure if it'll be out of lockdown then. By then, I have no idea. So you know, the LSO just don't play anymore, and so I'm just beginning to score Death on the Nile with Kenneth Branagh. Mm-hmm. So goodness knows what's going to happen. I wrote a little piece I mentioned it earlier recently for a solo violin and orchestra.
And you said for an album. Is there a Patrick Doyle album in the works?
No, what it is, it's an album that my agency, Iredell, Maggie Rodford, is producing, and it's for charity. For this whole crisis. And we've all been asked to submit a piece that perhaps was never recorded, or and I say, okay, I'll compose something for it. So I got the call on the Friday, and I'm in on the Monday, and I had a little melody for I composed a song for my former teacher who died about 4 or 5 years ago. She was my mentor, Edith Ferguson, and I used another melody to celebrate her life, and this was the sort of alternative one. And I thought, oh, this is I quite like this as well. So I used that and arranged it for this. So it's a song without words, so this wonderful guy came in, Tom Gould came in. He walked in to Iredell on his own. And, you know, he was prepared to walk in. There was no transport in London, and in the other booth, you know, separated was the engineer, and we recorded him. And it was a sample. The orchestra was Spitfire sounds, mostly strings, we all did a wonderful job of, you know, caressing these artificial strings. I wouldn't like to encourage it, certainly for the sake of this, it's like having interviewers on TV with Zoom. It's not ideal, but you know, there's a vibe to it which is of the moment. So it turned out rather lovely, actually, the piece. I'm very pleased with it. Again, you get the call a day and a half later, it's gone. You've done it. So it's one of those things, you know, that's why it's the world of the film composers, you know, with deadlines. And I like deadlines. I like being told, I need it for Wednesday. Great, you got it. You know, you know.
So. Great.
That's a great way to wrap up. I mean, it really is an experience to have a conversation with you. There's so much energy and positivity and fun. I can't imagine what it's like working on an entire film process.
Joyful.
Patrick Doyle.
Total joy. Always my favorite. And I think, Patrick, I really owe a lot of it to the first time I heard, I mean, I heard a number of scores, but it was Working on Great Expectations where I saw you work and I thought, any opportunity I have to work with Patrick Doyle, I'm going to take. Of course, you and I share, I've got a cookie for you forever. Patrick Doyle, we love you so much and look forward to hearing everything that comes up. In fact, I really hope that concert takes place in November, because that's something I would like to be in attendance for, to see a Patrick Doyle concert. So,
well, I'll give you a shout if it happens, because
please let us know.
Yeah, because the family are going to be involved as well. So, but anyway, if not, I'm sure they'll come back the following year. But the important thing is we all stay healthy and well.
That's Absolutely. Exactly right. What a perfect note to end on.
Reminder to our listeners to follow us. There's a number of ways: Twitter @ScoreThePodcast, Instagram @ScoreMovie, Facebook @ScoreMovie, or just search Score, a Film Music Documentary, and send us your questions to ScoreTheMailbox@epicleft.com. We'll try to answer those on the show. Stick around after the show. We're going to play a clip from Spitfire Audio so you can hear how to elevate your music. Robert, take it away.
Patrick Doyle, my favorite. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Patrick.
Thank you very much.
Great, great, fun show today. Score listeners, we're so grateful to be able to bring you shows like that with the support of Spitfire Audio. Mm-hmm. They collaborate with people like Hans Zimmer and the Bernard Herrmann Estate to build sample libraries that elevate your music. You're about to hear a musical demo of what that would sound like.
That's right. And a reminder again, as an exclusive to you, our Score listeners, Spitfire Audio is offering 20% off your first order. That's good on over 50 of their libraries. And again, it's exclusive to you, so feel real special.
Yep, just go to SpitfireAudio.com and enter the promo code SCORE2020, that's SCORE2020, so they know we sent you.
Now we're going to play you a little demo cue using the Spitfire Solo Strings package. Check it out.
Oh, that was cool. Hey, let's remind them, Kenny, we're off for a few weeks, but we're coming back with an incredible lineup of talent, really exciting guests coming up. Some of the biggest in the world we've been trying to get, we finally snagged them. So have a great little summer break. We will. And we'll see you in a few when we come back with episode 11.
11, that's right. And if you want to stick with us, follow us on social media @ScoreThePodcast on Twitter, @ScoreMovie on Instagram. We'll be announcing our big guests to come, so don't miss out on that. And we will see you soon. Thanks for listening to Score the Podcast.
See you in a few.